embodiment of everything that's excellent. It has no kind of fault or flaw, and I, my lords, embody the law. The constitutional guardian I of pretty young wards in Chancery, all very agreeable girls, and none are over the age of 21. A pleasant occupation for a rather susceptible chancellor.
A pleasant occupation for a rather susceptible chancellor.
If you had asked me who I wanted to be when I grew up, name one man, I would have said Martin Green. He was born in 1899. Martin Green was an actor and singer. He did a number of things. He was most famous working for decades for the Doyle Card Opera Company, the company that originally had put on the Gilbert and Sullivan light operas in the 1880s and 90s. And they went on until Margaret Thatcher destroyed them in late 1960s. He did the patter songs, you know, like he was Coco in The Mikado or Sir Joseph Porter in the Pinafore. And so he did the clever songs. When I was a lad, I served a term as office boy to an attorney's firm. I cleaned the windows and I swept the floor, and I polished up the handle of the big front door. Well, anyway, he was my hero. And people want to know why I talk so funny. It's because I grew up trying to talk like Martin Green when I was like 6 years old.
Martin Green, your hero. From, did you say Doyle Cart?
Doyle Cart, D'O. Richard Doyle Cart, or his real name was Richard Cart. Doyle was a middle name. Richard Doyle Cart was the entrepreneur who built the theater and managed the company.
I see.
Gilbert, of course, wrote the book and the lyrics, and Sir Arthur Sullivan wrote the music. It's the nearest thing to a good opera produced in the English language. And it's, to this day, you know, there are companies all over the United States and Britain that put on Gilbert and Sullivan operas. There are dozens and dozens of different film versions, incredible number of recordings. And each generation had a master of doing these parts. It goes back to George Grossmith in the original operas. And Martin Green took over fairly quickly in the 30s. And then in the 60s, 70s, 80s, it was John Reed. I don't think there is such a person now, but Martin Green.
Well, on the 22nd also, there was a young man who sat by the ocean in the sand and wrote himself a couple of songs, pretty much the only two songs. I'm going to play a little bit of each, and you'll get, most of you will understand who this guy is.
I wonder how you're feeling. There's ringing in my ears. And no one to relate to, save the sea. Shadows grow so long.
Yes, it's the one and only Peter Frampton. Yes, Peter Frampton, great rock artist. Yeah, I knew it was coming. Now, he had one of the most successful live albums ever recorded. He said, you know, I just was in that right mode and mood. I wrote these two songs. They both took maybe 20, 30 minutes apiece. And he said, I never really wrote anything that was as magical as those two songs. And those
God
two songs
him.
Were amazing.
If only he had quit when he was ahead. What are these two songs?
I played them.
Well, I know.
You'll have to wait and hear them. But anyway, those two songs made him as a rock artist. They're well written, they're short songs, they're kind of poppy love songs. That live album just captured the magic of those songs and the rest of the album as well.
Rock artist, isn't that one of those phrases they put in lists of things like military intelligence, you know, contradictions in terms?
Well, for us growing up in that era, gee, we're talking probably early to mid 70s. And, you know, to this day, Peter Frampton still tours. He does casinos and so forth, but an excellent guitarist. He was one of the first ones to use.
So does Barry Manilow, by the way.
He was one of the first ones to use a wah that makes that very interesting. That's what it sounds like. And it's a very amazing guitar with doing a mouth wah, interesting guitar.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm surprised Andres Segovia didn't cut his own throat at that time.
Right, or choked on the wah.
April 23rd, 1813, the most important political figure to work in the state of Illinois, not born in Illinois, was born. And can you guess who it was? Who's the greatest man in the history of Illinois politics?
Abraham Lincoln.
No. He wasn't born in Illinois either. He was born in Kentucky.
Yeah, that was pretty close.
Stephen Douglas, who was a Yankee who moved here. Douglas was a very powerful man. He was sort of an heir to those leaders of the U.S. Senate who had tried to broker compromise after compromise between northern interests and southern interests to avoid a war. Lincoln ran against him for the Senate and barely lost. And then again, they ran, and they were, of course, presidential candidates, and Lincoln won the election, as we all know. The problem was he was a crook. He was a land speculator.
Oh.
I was born in Douglas County, Wisconsin, named after Stephen Douglas because he and some Chicago land speculators bought a lot of land up there. But I think they got outfoxed by some Minneapolis land speculators who were closer to the scene.
Didn't they have some sort of debate? The Douglas
the Lincoln debate? Douglas debates
over.
The nearest one to Rockford was in Freeport. It was funny because Lincoln changed his tune at each venue because his basic position was, if you want to keep black people out of the state of Illinois, you have to keep slavery out. But the object is to keep Negroes out. Lincoln was Negrophobic in the extreme, like a lot of poor whites in the Upper South.
Well, that does not sound like the Abraham Lincoln that I...
Well, it sounds like the real Abraham Lincoln and not the cartoon cutout which they have sold the American people. You can imagine what they said about Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union of the 1950s, and it's about on par with what we were taught by Carl Sandburg and others about the great prevaricator, Abraham Lincoln.
Well, we're going to have a separate show on that one because I know you got some splaining to do, and so we'll maybe do that one as a hero and a villain, I guess.
No, but villain and villain.
Villain.
I try to look for the good points. The only thing good I've ever said about Lincoln is that it was wrong to assassinate him because he was a poor woman's husband and the father of children, and you shouldn't run around killing strangers like that.
I've always said that, even before I knew you, I used to say that. Here is another artist. It must be the artist month because this guy, I'm going to give you a couple songs and you're going to tell me who this guy is. I don't know if you like him or not. I thought he was awesome.
Every time I look into your loving eyes, I see love that money just can't buy. One look from you, I drift.
Pretty Woman, Crying, Blue Bayou.
It's unfair to call Roy Orbison awesome because awesome is reserved. How'd you like that lollipop? Awesome. How'd you like that gob of spit on the sidewalk your dog just licked up? Awesome. Roy Orbison was a good, he starts out as a sort of rockabilly performer.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought his performances were, to put it mildly, over the top.
Yes.
And very
bigger
emotional.
Bigger and bigger and bigger.
And I didn't like him when he was much at the height of his popularity. He made me cringe a little bit.
Mm.
I preferred Carl Perkins. You know, Carl Perkins
Who?
Had sort of, Carl, you know, Carl Perkins.
Carl
blue,
Perkins.
Blue suede shoes.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay,
Matchbox.
Oh, sure, okay.
You know, several songs of Carl Perkins were covered by the Beatles later on.
Nice.
And because he had a certain smart-ass edge, a certain irony.
Ah.
But later on, as I got older and maybe more soft-headed and sentimental, I've actually grown to like Roy Orbison a lot.
Hmm.
And I think a song like Crying, because he's crying in every song.
Yeah,
but he was a nice person.
Van Halen actually did the cover of Pretty Woman, which kind of revitalized the song. Pretty cool, their version of it. But to be honest with you, I like Roy Orbison's version much better. That was 1936 on the 23rd when he was born.
On the 24th of April, 1815, one of my two or three favorite English novelists was born, Anthony Trollope. Trollope was the son of a well-known writer and a father who never amounted to much, and he had to make his own way. He was a postal clerk. Pretty much a screw-up until a certain point in his life when he was sent to Ireland. They got rid of him from London, from the post office. Hmm. And in Ireland, he had to spend his life in the saddle and running from one primitive Irish village to another. Trollope's great novels, that is, the collection of novels called the Barsetshire novels, things like Barchester Towers, The Last Chronicle of Barset, or the Palliser novels, which are about English political life, or maybe his single best novel, The Way We Live Now. These are a brilliant social and moral analyses that are, on the one hand, extremely popular and easy to read. They're very charming. And on the other hand, they go deep to the heart of many moral and political questions. I've read all of Trollope virtually, much of it two or three times, and I've never read even one of his poorest books that I didn't thoroughly enjoy and coming away knowing more about my fellow man as a result of reading him. I can't think of an English novelist I would recommend more highly. There's Walter Scott, Jane Austen, and Anthony Trollope, and I guess Thackeray. Those, for me, are the height of the English
novel. If he was such a good writer, how come they ostracized him from his homeland? Ostracized him. They kicked him out.
He didn't get kicked out.
You said he had to go to Ireland.
Well, he said they got rid of him. They transferred him. He came back, and actually, once he got his feet on the ground, he was so successful as a postal executive that he was sent to Australia to revise and rehabilitate the Australian postal system. Huh. Spent there, like, I don't know, 2 years, and I believe invented the mailbox while he was there as a solution to speeding up rural mail delivery. You know, but instead of having to go up to the door to deliver mail.
Oh, drop boxes, yeah.
Yeah. He was quite successful. We have a little podcast with Stephen Heiner on one of Trollope's very last novels where he imagines, it's called The Fixed Limit, where you're not allowed to live past the age of 68. Hmm. Trollope was 68, by the way, when he wrote the book.
I see.
And so they have forced euthanasia. And it's really brilliant. One of his last books is one of his most brilliant performances. He never quit. No one else writing in English wrote so many really good novels. And how he did it, I don't know, because he wasn't terribly smart. He wasn't terribly intellectual. He was a daydreamer all his life, and a sort of a hack the way he wrote. He'd say, well, I need 1,500 words a day. I'll get up early, have a cup of coffee, I'll write it, then I get dressed, then I go to the post office, to my office.
Well,
he wrote like a machine, and he put this all into his autobiography, and when it was published, people say, oh, the guy's just a hack. Why did I like his book so much if he writes like that? Finally, generations after his death, people then began to realize once again, there is a depth of wisdom in Trollope, and I don't know where he got it, except I think he got it from his ability to daydream his way into other people's lives and imagine what their life was like and how they lived. He's the greatest of the Victorian writers in English, I think. On the 25th of April, 1873, was born one of the nicer and more interesting poets of the 20th century in England, Walter de la Mare. He, too, had a boring job. It's interesting. You know, A.E. Housman worked in the patent office. Trollope worked in the post office. Walter de la Mare worked for 18 years for Anglo-American Oil, known in America as Standard Oil. I think he worked in the statistics and accounting department. He wrote a lot of very popular children's stories and children's poetry. He wrote fiction of the supernatural, the creepy, the horror. His Memoirs of a Midget is one of the strangest books in the English language.
Sounds strange.
Literally, that is what it is. It's this midget girl, and she tells her life story. He had a tremendous imagination and enormous charm. He wrote many fine poems. This, I'm going to recite his most popular poem, and it used to be in the Oxford Book of English Verse. I don't know if it still is. It's called The Listeners. And in this poem, Delamere gives the feel, this eerie, creepy feeling where nothing is quite explained and it doesn't have to. "Is there anybody there?" said the traveler, knocking on the moonlit door. And his horse in the silence champed the grass of the forest's ferny floor. And a bird flew up out of the turret above the traveler's head. And he smote upon the door again a second time. "Is there anybody there?" he said. But no one descended to the traveler. No head from the leaf-fringed sill leaned over and looked into his gray eyes, where he stood perplexed and still, but only a host of phantom listeners that dwelt in the lone house then stood listening in the quiet of the moonlight to that voice from the world of men, stood thronging the faint moonbeams on the dark stair that goes down to the empty hall, hearkening in an air stirred and shaken by the lonely traveler's call. And he felt in his heart their strangeness, their stillness answering his cry, while his horse moved, cropping the dark turf neath the starred and leafy sky. For he suddenly smote on the door even louder and lifted his head. "Tell them I came." And no one answered, "that I kept my word," he said. Never the least stir made the listeners, though every word he spake fell echoing through the shadowiness of the still house from the one man left awake. Aye, they heard his foot upon the stirrup and the sound of iron on stone, and how the silence surged softly backward when the plunging hooves were gone.